This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain. The solar energy business is booming, but it's got a lot of ground to make up before it matches the big sources of electricity generation in this country: coal, natural gas, and nuclear. This hour, we're going to talk about the state of the solar power business. Joining us first is Bobby McGill. He's a senior science writer at Climate Central. He covers energy and climate change, and he's also covered Western energy and environmental issues as a freelance writer for Popular Mechanics. Bobby McGill, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you.
Hi. So we're going to talk about the solar power business for this hour, and I want to talk kind of with that point at the top here about how fast it's growing. I see these reports every year, double-digit growth, but it still makes up less than 1% of all the power generation in the country. Why is that?
So there are a number of things going on here. Costs have fallen quite a bit. So rooftop solar costs have dropped roughly 29% between 2010 and 2013. That's a lot. Industry says that the cost of a solar panel has dropped by more than 60% since 2010. And with rebates, tax credits, and other incentives, a rooftop solar system can cost under $10,000 unless you're leasing a rooftop system, which can bring the cost down to nearly nothing. There are a number of other things going on as well. So there's a rush to develop solar projects before a solar investment tax credit expires next year. That gives solar developers about a 30% federal tax credit on new solar power systems that are developed. Also, many states have renewable portfolio standards, so they require their utilities to generate a certain percentage of their electricity from renewables. And so that's one of the reasons you see southern states like North Carolina becoming a major solar player. North Carolina is one of the only states in the South with renewable portfolio standards. Yeah. And, you know, looking farther down – oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say I want to talk more about North Carolina in a few minutes here, because that's a really interesting case. But I really want to get into this point of double-digit growth. That's not little growth, and it's been sustained over a long period of time. But when I look, I was checking out the Department of Energy's website this morning and looking at where America's electricity comes from. Still, 39% of it comes from coal, 27% from natural gas, 19% from nuclear. You have to go all the way down the list to about a quarter of 1%, and you get to solar. Why is it such a small percent? Because it seems to have a fair amount of support among the public. Why is it having such a hard time making up ground if it's growing so fast?
Well, it was a small industry to begin with, and other countries have sort of beat us to that. Europe, for example, has, Germany was in this game long before the U.S. was, and Europe developed, say, offshore wind farms before the U.S. did. So we've been a little bit behind the curve, but I mean, there's a ton of potential there. For example, the industry says that the total number of solar photovoltaic systems, those are solar panels, in the U.S. grew 485% between 2010 and 2013. That's a lot. And mm-hmm. So they're expecting, the total amount of solar generating capacity that the U.S. has, or had at the end of 2014, to double by 2016. So, we had about 20 gigawatts of solar generating capacity last year, and that's enough to provide enough electricity for about 4 million people. And that, like I said, it could double by 2016. Another interesting thing is that California was the first state last year to generate 5% of its total electricity from solar, and that grew from 1.9% just the year before. So, it's happening. It's taking a little bit of time, but it looks like it's really taking off.
And so California jumping from just under 2% to 5% of its electricity from solar. That's not all from solar panels on top of roofs, right?
Correct. I mean, that's utility scale. That's these large solar farms out in the middle of the desert there. There are two different kinds of solar that are developed there. There's the concentrating solar, and there's the the massive arrays of solar panels. But most of the growth is in photovoltaics for the solar panels.
Yeah, you said
there's a lot of
Go ahead. I'm sorry. You said utility scale there a few minutes ago. What do you mean by that, utility scale?
So there's a difference between the kind of solar that people put on rooftops. That's a kind of it's called distributed generation because it's not centralized. You don't have a one major power plant in a certain place that provides electricity to a lot of to customers all over a region. It's local and it's spread on rooftops throughout an entire region. But utility scale is this centralized. Think of a coal-fired power plant. It's operated by a utility and is distributed. And that electricity is distributed into the grid for millions of people to use. And so that's what utility scale is on for solar as well.
Right. And these plants are kind of extraordinary. They can be out in the middle of nowhere and huge sort of footprint, big circles of mirrors. Have you seen one of these facilities?
I have. One of them is actually that I've seen is actually much smaller than that. I haven't seen any of the ones in California. I haven't been out there yet to visit those. But there's one in western Colorado that is in this broad Red Rock Valley I don't know how big it is, but it's quite striking. It's juxtaposed with the mountains in the background, but it's in the middle of nowhere. There's not another city for 100 miles in any direction. One of the trends now, of course, is to build those solar farms, if you will, closer to cities. And there's a broad swath of the South, for example, that has a lot of solar generating potential. So we're seeing more of those farms be built there. In fact, there's a large development around San Antonio, Texas, right now that's in the process of being built. Mostly of smaller installations.
Right. These big utility scale projects that you're talking about, they can be controversial, right? I mean, because you're building them in some natural areas there where you have other animals using them and things.
So, I mean, a lot of these are built on public lands. The Bureau of Land Management is one of the largest A lot of these projects have been built in Southern California on Bureau of Land Management land that is relatively wild. And when you build a solar project there, it pretty much crowds out just about every other use of the land. It helps to fragment the wildlife habitat there, and it can be an incredibly impactful use of land that was previously wild. And there have also been incidents of, especially in these concentrating solar facilities, where birds might fly into them harm. They could die.
Right. And I guess when most of us think of solar, we think of environmentally friendly. But some of these projects have actually pit small environmental groups concerned about those local effects of this industrial scale sort of plant against some of the larger groups who have climate change as more of a concern.
Correct. So, I mean, you have to balance the potential impact of some of these projects with the overall greater good of developing, relatively environmentally sound or at least low impact, low emission energy sources. There's no form of energy that's going to have zero impact at all. So you have to weigh the costs and benefits.
Right. And you wrote about building some of these intense plants in more urban areas. How do you accomplish that? Because it looks like they need like a big open space to work.
Well, there was a study that was written about that recently, as far as I understand, they would use undeveloped areas within urban areas, so empty lots and whatnot, but also maybe lands around the edges of urban areas as well. So And not to mention, I mean, you can think of places like Southern Arizona, where, you know, if you go to Phoenix, you'll see supermarket parking lots that are that have these solar arrays that are suspended over parking lots, and so, you know, they can essentially use this land very efficiently use urban land very efficiently by putting solar panels on top of big box stores and doubling the use of parking lots, for example.
Well, let's talk about North Carolina, because this really surprised me, and I learned about this from you, that it's kind of a hot spot for solar development. I had no idea.
Well, one of the reasons that it's a hot spot is that it's one of the few states in the South with these renewable portfolio standards. So there's they have a mandate by 2021 for their large utilities or investor-owned utilities, IOUs, to generate 12.5% of their power from renewables by that year. And if you're a smaller like a municipality that has its own electric co-op, you know, that's they have to generate a slightly smaller percent of their power from renewables by 2018. And so with the tax credit possibly expiring next year or being reduced a little bit, quite a bit, actually, there's a bit of a rush to develop in North Carolina.
Renewable portfolio standard. That's one of those terms that my editor at NPR won't let me use. So
right.
I think you did a good job of explaining it there, but I want to kind of just explain it again. This is essentially a regulator telling utilities that by a certain date, you're going to get this percent of your electricity from renewable sources. And that's a big boost to this business, right?
Business. It is. So you have a state like Colorado, which initially had, you know, it created this standard, this mandate that 20% of its electricity be produced by, say if you're Xcel Energy in Colorado, 20% would have had to be produced by renewables. But that was so successful that they upped it to 30%. Some other states, like I believe it was Ohio, they froze their renewable portfolio standard until 2017 for a variety of reasons. But most states outside of the South have developed these requirements for large utilities. One of the biggest is
we're gonna have to take a little bit of a break here, but we're gonna come back and we're gonna talk a little bit about the jobs that come with some of these projects, because this has become an employment thing for a lot of people. We're talking with Bobby McGill. He is a science writer at Climate Central, where he focuses on energy and climate change. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call, 1-888-477-9444. You can also email radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We'll be back after a break. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the solar power business this hour. We have Bobby McGill from the publication Climate Central. He reports on energy and climate change there. If you want to join the conversation, he's going to be here for a few more minutes. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And let's talk about jobs, because if you have an industry that is growing by double-digit numbers every year, there's a lot going on there, and employment has been increasing pretty rapidly. You wrote about this here a couple weeks
back. That's true.
Yeah.
So early this month, there was what's called the National Solar Jobs Census, and that found that the solar sector grew about 22%. The employment in the solar sector grew about 22% last year, adding about 31,000 jobs, and another 36,000 are expected to be added in 2015. So currently, we have about 174,000 people employed in the solar sector nationwide, and obviously that's going to grow quite a bit. The industry is booming, and so is employment. A lot of the jobs that are available are installers. the more people who want solar panels on their roofs need people to install them, and those are apparently fairly lucrative positions.
That surprised me that most of the jobs were installers. You could imagine, you know, like you would need designers and people who can produce panels and all that sort of stuff. But it's the people who actually install them that's where the jobs are.
Correct.
And they pay pretty good, you said?
I don't have that number on my fingertips, but they do pay relatively well. Looks like the average solar installer makes $24 an hour, and the average solar salesperson $36 per hour. So I'd say that's pretty good pay.
Yeah. I saw those statistics, and it is sort of interesting when you think about manufacturing jobs or other kinds of jobs. It's pretty decent pay. And are these jobs that take a lot of training to get?
Well, it looks like that they do not require a college degree. So if you have, a high level of technical skill, you're a pretty good candidate for that position.
All right. Well, we're going to take one telephone call. We have Doug on the phone from Trenton. Doug, you're on Radio Times.
Super. Yes, my name is Doug O'Malley. I'm the director with Environment New Jersey based in Trenton. So excited to talk about this issue, mainly because New Jersey has just been a huge supporter of solar. We've gone from 5 solar installations 14 years ago to close to 33,000. And just this week, the Board of Public Utilities issued nearly $3 million in grants for energy storage projects related to solar, which is just especially critical because solar can provide a lot of benefit through resiliency projects, which is critical in a post-Sandy world. And I'm curious just to hear more on how solar will be changed by energy storage and how important solar can be as a resiliency backup option.
Right. And Bobby McGill, that's a big issue for this industry, isn't it? Because you can only, if you have solar panels, you can only generate electricity when the sun is shining and you can't store it.
Right. Right, and that's one of the biggest challenges facing renewable power these days. So, if it's midnight, there's a pretty good chance you're not getting most of your electricity from solar power unless you have battery backup. There are a number of projects being developed nationwide multi-megawatt storage projects for renewables, and the idea is that it stores solar power for later, but it also helps smooth out the flow of that energy on the grid, because it's so the solar power is so highly variable. This allows allow it to flow onto the grid very smoothly, so to speak, and it actually helps grid managers manage the flow of energy a lot better.
Right. We've received a couple of comments from people writing to us on Facebook and email asking if there was sort of a thing. I think it showed up on my Facebook page a while back about solar paneled roads. Do you remember seeing that? And do you know anything at all about that? Because
I don't know much about that. I think that was an experiment in Europe. I'd love to know more about that.
Yeah, this is certainly an industry where there's a lot of things going on. And when you have all of that growth and the technology has changed, I mean, when you already talked about how solar panel prices have come down so much. So there's going to be a lot to talk about here for many years to come. Bobby McGill, a senior science writer at Climate Central, thank you so much for helping us start off this discussion here on Radio Times. And we're going to say goodbye to Bobby McGill now, and welcome to the program Vera Cole. She is the president of the Mid-Atlantic Renewable Energy Association, and she's also the lead faculty of Penn State's Energy and Sustainability Policy Online BA degree. Vera Cole, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, Jeff. It's nice to be here.
Yes, so it's good to have you. And First off, tell me a little bit about your organization, the Mid-Atlantic Renewable Energy Association.
Thanks for asking. We are a 501c3 nonprofit devoted to education and advocacy work related to renewable energy and really all things sustainable. We have monthly meetings on the last Tuesday of every month at our at a location in just outside of Kutztown, Pennsylvania, and those meetings are free and open to the public. And there's more information about other events and membership and a ton of resources on our website, which is themareya.org.
And I have been out to see the solar power system at your home. Very impressive. These are not rooftop solar panels, but you have them out in a field beside your house. Tell me about your system.
Our system was, we have a 9.6 kW system, kilowatt system, that's been there for a couple of years now. It's pole mounted. Our roofs were not, I would have preferred to have done a roof mount, but none of our roofs are south facing. Of course, you need a south facing site for solar. But the pole mounts work great. They're high enough that there's no interference with the ground use underneath. And ours can be adjusted manually to change the tilt seasonally, which we do. And they work exactly as expected with zero maintenance, which is just my kind of thing.
And you use electricity from your solar panels for your car.
That's right. I have a Volt, and so the way a solar installation works is that the solar from our panels is wired directly into the electrical panel box in our home, so the electricity, once it goes from the panels to through the inverter into our breaker box, is the same as electricity from the utility company. And so once the electricity is there, whether it comes from the utility company or comes from the solar, it's used to serve whatever loads you need in the house. So it would be the refrigerator or my Volt if I have it plugged in. Whatever needs electricity at the time is served by the power that's available. So if I'm generating more electricity from my solar panels than I'm using at the time, that extra electricity gets sent back out to the grid. But in the evenings or other times when I'm using more electricity than my solar system is generating, then I can pull electricity from the grid. So when you say I do use my solar power, when I'm generating solar power and my Volt is plugged in, then yes, my Volt is using the power from my solar modules.
And so in a way, we were just talking about how difficult it is for this business to kind of come up with a way to store the electricity. You kind of get to store the electricity in your Volt, it sounds like.
Well, it's not exactly working that way right now. In a sense, you could say that, because I can charge my Volt, during the daytime, and I can drive my Volt in the evening. In that sense, it works that way. But I can't really pull power from my Volt at this point to power loads in my house. But that's not far down the road, I hope, with the smart grid.
Yeah, we were talking about the technology. It just seems to change quickly, and the prices have come down. I don't remember how long ago you installed your system, but I assume that even today it would be cheaper to install than it was when you put it in.
Oh, it's incredible how much prices have dropped. To your earlier point about why are we not doing more solar, I agree with that question entirely. I mean, the economics of it, for me, actually, the real driver is the clean energy aspect of it and the urgent need for this country and this planet to use more clean energy resources. But the economics are there, too. For example, when we first started tracking prices at Mareya, about when the Pennsylvania rebate program opened in 2009, it cost about $8 a watt to install solar in Pennsylvania. Now it's probably closer to $3 or $3.50 a watt to install solar, and that's just since 2009. So if you were to install solar now and pay about if you were to pay even as much as $3.50 a watt to install it, which is a very reasonable price to expect to pay, and we had no income from renewable energy credits if we didn't assume any of that. So it was just, we just install the system, we pay $3.50 a watt for it, and we get the federal tax credit, which was alluded to earlier, and that's 30% off the full price. And we expect that system, once it's installed, with very little maintenance, to continue to generate electricity for decades, for probably at least 25 years. Mm-hmm. So if we assume the system is going to be sitting there generating electricity for 25 years, the price we're going to pay for that electricity is 10 cents a kilowatt hour. That's 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Right now, according to data that just came out from the Energy Information Administration, the cost of New Jersey's electricity in 2013 was almost 16 cents a kilowatt hour, and in Pennsylvania, about 13 cents a kilowatt hour.
Huh. So if you go out and install a system today that can pretty much support what your house uses, is there sort of an estimate of how long it would take to sort of recover that initial investment? Because you could spend $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 installing them initially.
Right. You can easily spend tens of thousands of dollars installing them initially. In fact, that's if we say why are not more people not doing it, that's probably the single biggest barrier is the initial upfront cost. And also your site has to be appropriate. Like I said earlier, you have to have, you know, a considerable open space that has to be south-facing. But the payback period, so what I gave you before was just the cost of the electricity from the solar system. And that number we can come up with very little assumptions. That's just based on the actual cost of the system and very credible estimates of how much electricity that system's going to produce in its lifetime. When we start looking at things like the payback or return on investment, then we have to start making assumptions about the future. And the payback depends almost entirely on what your estimates are of the future price of electricity. In other words, how much cost am I going to be avoiding 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 25 years from now, when I'm still paying my 10 cents a kilowatt hour? What's the actual price of grid electricity going to be? So depending on those assumptions about the future price of grid electricity, that will determine my payback. So with very conservative assumptions, you say grid prices are not going to go up very much, then my payback might be 10 or 12 years. If I say, hey, all of these new rules are going to kick in from the EPA, we're going to have more and more pressure to address carbon issues, I think electricity prices are going to start to really climb in the coming years, then all of a sudden my solar payback is going to get better and better and better.
Right. And it's going to be different for everyone. So I guess the big thing here is you sit down and figure all that out before you spend that kind of money, which I think most people would do anyway. If you want to join the conversation, we're talking about the solar energy business this hour on Radio Times. The telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. And Vera Cole, here just a few minutes ago, you mentioned renewable energy credits. I've also heard them called SRECs, another term that my editor at NPR won't allow me to use. But as I understand it, SRECs stand for State Renewable Energy Certificates. Explain those SRECs to me.
All right. This is one of life's biggest challenges. And I have to tell
In 30 seconds.
It's actually solar renewable energy credits.
Oh, it's solar. Okay.
That's what the S stands for.
Okay.
And I hate to tell you this, but I can't explain SRECs without also saying the words renewable portfolio standard.
Okay.
So I will try to do this as simply as I can. But as was said earlier, a renewable portfolio standards, or RPS, are like state-level policies that say, in our state, so much electricity is going to, a certain percentage of electricity is going to come from clean energy sources. And those RPSs often have specifically call out how much has to come from solar. So a state will say a certain percentage of our electricity must come from solar energy resources, and that percentage is going to go up year after year after year after year. Well, the way that, so we say, wait, how do we make that happen? How do we prove that that happens? And we use a mechanism called a renewable energy credit, and when it comes from solar, it's called a solar renewable energy credit. So if I have a solar installation system, and I'm tied to the grid, and I generate, and I register my system with the state, then every time I generate 1,000 kilowatt hours of electricity from solar, I'm entitled to a certificate that's called a solar renewable energy credit, or an SREC.
Okay.
So I get an SREC for every 1,000 kilowatt hours I generate.
And then you can go out and sell it on a market. Essentially, it's a way to subsidize the cost of that expensive cost of initially building a system, right?
That's exactly how it works. And so the companies that are providing electricity in the state have to turn over a number of SRECs to prove that they've met this requirement for solar energy. And so they buy the SRECs from system owners on an open market. And so the price of those SRECs is set by supply and demand, where the demand for SRECs is determined by the portfolio standard, and the supply of SRECs is determined by how many installations are registered in that state and how much electricity they're generating.
We can really get in the weeds quickly and we're going to try to avoid that because people feel passionately about solar. And we're going to get to some phone calls after we take a break. But I want to talk about just briefly about solar development is not the same everywhere. And if you look over in New Jersey, it seems like there's a lot more activity happening than here in Pennsylvania. Why is that?
Well, it's the dreaded word again. It's the renewable portfolio standards. It's the primarily it's the difference between that. Both states used to have rebate programs. Neither state does now. Both states rely almost entirely on their RPS to drive solar. In Pennsylvania, our standards for our goal for 2015 is to have 0.25%, a quarter of 1% of our energy come from solar. By contrast, in New Jersey plans to have over 2% of their electricity come from solar in 2015. And so those are that's probably the single biggest driver in the amount of solar. So that sets the demand for RECs, that drives the price for RECs. In Pennsylvania, our SREC prices are about $40 right now, and New Jersey, they are about $200 right now.
So it's mostly a policy issue, and we recently had a change in administrations here in Pennsylvania. Do you see a change coming in Pennsylvania then?
It'll be interesting to see. We have the governor's budget did include provisions for returning to the state rebate program for funding that again. We've also had several bills introduced recently to increase our portfolio standards in Pennsylvania and to permanently fund the rebate program. So I'm hopeful. We'll see.
We're talking about the solar energy business this hour on Radio Times. Right now, we have on the telephone Vera Cole. She's the president of the Mid-Atlantic Renewable Energy Association. If you want to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also email radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Now, this is a complicated business. We're fortunate to have a few people on the telephone who can answer some questions. So let's hear what your questions are. And when we come back from our break, we're going to answer some of them. This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady and for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the solar energy business this hour. You can join the conversation 1-888-477-9499. Right now on the telephone, we have Vera Cole. She is the president of the Mid-Atlantic Renewable Energy Association. And Vera, if you don't mind, we're going to take a little phone call here. First, we're going to go to Linda from South River, New Jersey. Linda, you are on Radio Times. Linda. Well, it sounds like Linda is not on the telephone right now, but her question was one that had came up here about a year or so back. There was a fire over in New Jersey on a warehouse where there were some solar panels on the roof, and there was some concern about fighting that fire and having solar panels on the roof. Is this something that you're familiar with, Vera?
No, I remember the headlines, but honestly, I'm not familiar with the details of that particular situation.
Okay.
I do know that it's I have friends in the business who talk about the concerns over solar fires are really really overstated. There's so much the permitting and the specifications for how these systems are required are installed are so very well thought out and so carefully done that it's really there's far more hazards from your toaster oven catching on fire, I think, than from a solar system. So they get a lot of publicity when they do happen, but solar systems are really very very safe.
I know that case did bring up issues for some policymakers and had a lot of people thinking about it, and that's something that people have considered now.
One of the ways that does tie in is, we have just an example of the safety. We talk about if a solar electric system does not have battery backup, it will not work when the grid goes down, when the grid power fails. And part of the reason for that is that it's a safety reason that the inverters switch off instantly if they sense that there's no power on the grid. And that's to make sure that these systems are turned off and there's no risk to workers. by lines that are powered unexpectedly.
Sure. I want to get into another issue because there are different ways you can get solar panels on your roof. You can buy them. There are lease programs out there. And let's go back to the telephone to with someone who has a question that kind of gets into this issue. And I think I know who this person is, Mark from Yardley, Pennsylvania. Mark, you're on Radio Times. Maybe introduce yourself because you install solar panels for a living, right?
Yes, that's right. Hello, my name's Mark Portman, and I own a company. We install solar panels for residential systems and also small commercial.
And this idea of buying them versus leasing a system, what do you think?
There's lots of different ways to pay for a system. You and Vera had been talking about the payback period a couple minutes ago. If you finance a system either through a home equity loan or a small business loan, or even banks have the special solar loan programs, the customer is often cash flow positive right from the start, meaning that the amount they're going to save on their utility bill each month outweighs the monthly payment on their loans. In the residential sector, leasing has become very popular, and leasing works very similar to a loan in terms of the homeowners agree to make a monthly payment over a course of a number of years in return for letting this company put solar panels on the roof.
Right. And we did a story about this on NPR, and it really depends a lot on what your priorities are. If you don't have the money to invest up front, it sounds like leasing might be the best option. But if you do have the money and want to and the savings are most important, then buying is probably the best option. Vera, where do you come down on that leasing versus buying issue?
It depends on the circumstances. The biggest difference in those two is your ability to come up with the upfront capital and or financing. As we talked about earlier, they can be expensive. You know, the initial cost can be expensive. Another option is a power purchase agreement, which is also a third party option where a third party owns an installation on your site and you agree to buy that the electricity generated by that system at a certain fixed rate.
Okay.
So power purchase agreements and leasing are both ways to avoid the upfront cost and to still have solar installed and operating on your site. I would point out, though, that many people, for various reasons, none of these three options work for them. It could be that their site is not every site, in fact, many are not suitable for solar. You need to have the space, you need to have solar access, you need to be south-facing. So many people who would be able and willing to invest in solar aren't able to because of the conditions of the circumstances of their property. And then there are also people who are renters who don't own their property but would like to have to be using clean electricity. And so for those two groups and for all of us, really, both Pennsylvania and New Jersey offer the ability to choose your generation source. So you can, through your utility company, you can choose to buy your electricity from clean energy sources, and that can be solar, it can be wind, it can be, you can even require that it be generated locally. You can pick companies like Community Energy or Ethical Energy, and there's many others, to buy so that you're using clean electricity even though it's not actually installed on your property.
So much to talk about in the solar energy business here. I want to spend the last 10 minutes or so of our program talking about policy. And to do that, I'm going to bring in David Wright. He's a former National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners. He was the president of that organization, which is affectionately known as NARUC among those who follow this sort of thing. And he served as a commissioner for the South Carolina Public Service Commission for a decade. David Wright, welcome to Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I want to kind of get into the idea of this, of having solar panels out on people's roofs, and that's where they get their electricity, as opposed to the old system or the existing system that has served us all well for many decades of centralized power plants and then the electricity distributed out. Just that change creates kind of a revolution in for the business and for regulation, doesn't it?
It sure does. It's not something that it actually came a lot quicker, I think, than people anticipated it coming, even though they've seen it coming since, I don't know, the early 2000s, I think.
Right. And so what are some of the – so one of the issues that kind of gets brought up then in this is this issue of net metering. Maybe you can help us explain what net metering is.
Well, net metering, just as a policy, wouldn't exist at all without a connection to the grid. And the grid's been there for, you know, well over 100 years. And it's got to adapt to what's going on. But I guess net metering, if you just kind of boil it down, if you have a rooftop solar system, the homeowner who has that system can use his power that he's generating from his solar arrays on his house to power his home. If he has excess power, that is then sold back to the utility. And in most states, the way this thing happened when it first came down, there was so little of it was generated, people just said, well, we'll just sell it back at the retail rate. And that has now, I think, over time, now they're seeing that that might not have been a wise decision in some of these states, and they're taking another look at the net metering policy and how to implement it and what is the right way to do it.
If you're accustomed to buying something wholesale and selling it retail, and all of a sudden you're buying it retail and selling it retail, that's not a winning business proposition, I guess.
Yes, that's right.
Well, let's bring Vera Cole back into the conversation. You're an advocate for renewable energy. Why is net metering an important policy for states to maintain around the country?
Well, it's just as we've described it. Solar and other renewables are intermittent, and you're not always going to, unless you have storage on your own property, you're not going to be able to maintain meet your loads at all times unless you have net metering. And so, like we just said, net metering means that, you know, when you have extra generation, you send it to the grid, and when you need more, you pull it from the grid, and you're billed for the net amount. And so the ability to do that is really important because it gives you the opportunity to size your system so that you can meet your annual loads and not size it necessarily for seasonal or daily loads. And it also brings about, though, net metering has many general benefits beyond the individual system owner. For example, it reduces loads on the grid. And when you think about solar in particular, solar is most active on a hot summer day. On a bright, sunny summer day, and that's the same time when our peak loads are generally coincides pretty well with peak loads, which are when everybody's hot and running your air conditioner. So solar is contributing to the grid. It's taking power off the grid, taking demand off the grid at a time when the grid most needs it. When we have solar with battery backup and we have microgrids, we start to have more resiliency and more power during our grid failures. Those systems can all operate fine during grid failures. They reduces our overall vulnerability. When we use solar and net metering, and the generation happens on the site where the electricity is used, we're not using transmission and distribution, and there's like 6%, the government estimates about 6% energy losses just during transmission and distribution. So it's much more efficient to generate electricity on the site where it's used. As we said before, these installations create local jobs, and probably of most important is it's clean energy. And in the era of, you know, the threat of the very real and urgent need to do something to address climate change, these systems contribute greatly to that.
And right now we're having battles around the country before state utility commissions about net metering and exactly how it's going to be structured. David Wright, how do you think it should be structured?
Right. Well, before I go there, just let me respond real quick to Vera. I don't think that the solar doesn't always line up to peak from a utility perspective, where because a lot of times people get home at work from work in the afternoon cooking dinner, the sun's not shining. And so solar is not contributing to that peak time. And sometimes very early in the morning before the sun comes up. When people are using, so it doesn't line up exactly, but there is benefit. I recognize that. Mm-hmm. But from a net metering proposal to your question, you know, I think that everything we're looking at here, because there is a lack of federal policy here, we don't know whether the Congress wants to be clean, green, or independent. We really don't know. But what we do know is that states have to lead, and that's what states are doing. And every region of the country, every state in the country is going to look at this thing differently. You know, you've got you've got resources in the Northwest, which are highly water. You've got in the Southwest, which is mainly sun. The Midwest is high wind. The South pretty much is a hodgepodge, but they're not real big on anything. You know, Congressman Clyburn says down in South Carolina, we don't have enough wind to mess up a golf shot. But we're still trying to develop that resource. So every state's policy is going to be different. Some states I've heard you talk all morning about renewable portfolio standards. Some states aren't going to do it. So it's going to be goals that your legislative bodies set that the regulatory agencies are going to have to implement, and that will affect cost and how the pricing is determined.
Hmm. And Vera Cole, do you think that it's okay to kind of duke this out at every state around the country, or does there need to be kind of an overall sort of federal way of implementing this growing industry?
Well, I think we all would benefit from policy certainty. I think that all the stakeholders could make better decisions and could move and invest with more confidence if we had some policy certainty. I wish it could come from the federal level, but I think it's far more likely it will continue to happen at the state level. What we really need is a fair way to and a full scope for gauging the benefits of distributed generation and net metering for all that are involved, not just for the individuals. And I think every solar owner I know is very willing to pay a fair share if fairly evaluated, certainly wants to pay their fair share for supporting the grid that we all know and need and count on. I would add that I think of a new factor on the horizon is that with advances in storage, more and more there's more discussion about grid defection becoming a real possibility of just being able to set up your own, to be off-grid entirely with your own storage. In fact, a recent study from the Rocky Mountain Institute says that a considerable number of utility customers will see favorable defection economics within 10 years. You know, at some point, getting off the grid is going to become a valid option, I think, for many. And, I mean, like, when you think about it, how many homes do you know now that have no phone landline? That was unthinkable about 10 years ago. So I think it's in the public interest to maintain a robust, reliable, responsive grid that's got, you know, high levels of customer engagement to support and fund it. But above all else, we urgently need to move to clean energy sources. And so I think, in keeping with what your other guest is saying, we need policies and business models that encourage private investment in clean energy. We need them to be aligned and to encourage investment that's distributed and chooses and continues to choose to be grid-tied.
And David Wright, do you have a sense that that regulators can sort of move swiftly enough to kind of keep up with this fast-moving business?
Well, they're going to have to, and I do believe there's a lot of different groups that are involved in this, and under the NARUC umbrella, this is something that they're working on almost daily. I mean, it's going to be critically important to everybody that our policies that going forward recognize the value of the grid, not just the customers, but to anybody who has or doesn't even have distributed generation. We're going to have to be transparent in rate design and the ways that we do rate design and rate making. We're going to have to recognize technological changes that are occurring on the system every day and reflect the true cost because, like I said earlier, net metering exists today only because there's a grid, but if you do have defections like Vera was just talking about, once you're disconnected from the grid, it doesn't matter. You're on your own, and that's not what we're talking about as a state regulator. Because if they're not on the grid, we can't protect them.
Yeah, I agree. It's to everyone's benefit for as many of us to stay grid-tied as possible, certainly.
Well, a lot to talk about here, and we got a lot of phone calls and a lot of comments, but unfortunately, there was only 1 hour. I think we could spend 2 or 3 hours on this talk, but thank you both for being here. Vera Cole is president of the Mid-Atlantic Renewable Energy Association and the lead faculty of Penn State's Energy and Sustainability Policy online degree. David Wright is a former National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners president, and he served as a commissioner for the South Carolina Public Service Commission for a decade. Thank you both for being here on Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain.